Hello and welcome to The Wire on this Thursday, 2nd of April. We're Community and Indigenous Radio's National Independent Current Affairs Program. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. And as we become increasingly familiar with lockdowns and the changed world that coronavirus has thrust on us, we're bringing you the news that matters. Today, we hear direct from New York, where the ravages of the virus have nearly brought a thriving city to a standstill. Meanwhile, in remote Australia, Indigenous communities and particularly those with disabilities need more support and clear communication. Also today, Parliament may be closed across Australia, and as the politicians and staffers bunker down at home, some support services are changing their focus to those in need. And art lovers, don't despair. Galleries are scrambling to move online and create spaces to play and learn. Stay with us for the next half hour. But first, we've got a quick wrap of what's been going on around the country and the world today. And my colleague Annie Haswell is here to join me.
Hi, Sarah. Well, the total number of coronavirus cases worldwide has surpassed 900,000 today, heading for the million mark, with 5,108 here in Australia. There's been more than 45,000 deaths recorded globally and 23 in Australia. Recoveries stand at 193,700 globally, with 422 in Australia. And looking internationally, the USA, UK, Spain, Germany, France and Iran are the current hotspots for the virus, with increasingly high infection rates. The good news, though, is that Australia has shown signs of an early flattening curve with a smaller number of new cases of COVID-19.
How's the situation with the Ruby Princess ship infections?
Well, the number of cases linked to it have now crossed 500, which is 11.5% of Australia's national total. There are as many as 6,000 people stranded on ships that are unable to disembark. And the government's currently facing a dilemma about how to control the pandemic on these ships because of the high risk in transporting passengers or providing outside help in isolation. So those ships are left with nowhere to go, and operators may not be able to disembark their passengers until the end of April.
Wow, that's terrible. And what was said in the Prime Minister's press conference this morning?
Well, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced that childcare will be made completely free of cost across Australia. With schools closing tomorrow, this will come as a big relief for parents who are still working out of home and have children to look after. Education Minister Dan Tehan said the $1.6 billion package will become effective as of Sunday night, and childcare centres should also seek to re-enrol parents that previously dropped out due to financial stress. Essential workers will be prioritised, but the subsidy is available for everyone.
Is there an update on the vaccine being developed in Australia?
Well, yes, scientists at the CSIRO have said that a vaccine could still take another year to create. Trials are being carried out in Victoria at the moment, where ferrets are being used as test animals. Human trials will begin very soon, but even then it's going to be quite difficult to make the vaccine available globally in such a short time.
And some good news for the community sector.
Yes, philanthropic organisation, the Judith Nielsen Institute, today announced three new initiatives to support media organisations and journalists during the disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. One of these is funding to the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia to enable it to provide its national radio news service free of charge for 6 months. Currently, more than 80 stations pay a subscription fee for service, which reaches some 1.3 million listeners a week. But making the service free will allow Australia's 450 community stations to access the service for free, giving it a total potential reach of 5.8 million listeners a week. And this is what Executive Director of JNI, Mark Ryan, had to say.
We consulted widely across the industry and across the entire media industry to try and find ways of getting support to those people who most need it, but not just support in the sense of putting a bit of money into journalists' pockets right now, but also generating quality content to get out to as broad an audience as possible. And that's really where community radio comes in. Not many people realise just how far and how deep community radio reaches into the Australian community. And when we heard that the Community Radio Network's news service was under stress, as most newsrooms are, we were keen to help where we could.
And the other two initiatives announced today by JNI are support to RMIT University for ABC Fact Check to help tackle misinformation on COVID-19, including on social media, and extra support for freelance journalists.
Thanks, Annie. Mm-hmm. self-isolation and social distancing are concepts that don't translate well to close-knit Aboriginal communities, particularly when warnings are delivered through mainstream media in English. The risks of miscommunication are high, especially for members of those communities living with disability, who may have heightened risks of contracting COVID-19. Damien Griffiths is Chief Executive Officer of the First Peoples Disability Network Australia. He spoke with The Wire's Jared McLaughlin about his concerns for First Nations communities.
We see a serious lack of meaningful response by government to really understand the needs of First Peoples with disability. It's difficult to think of any more vulnerable or disadvantaged Australians than Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability, because they often face discrimination and disadvantage based on Aboriginality and disability. And as a group, they are extremely vulnerable to the coronavirus.
What do you think can be done to get state, territory and federal governments to enact more sufficient and more broader responses to try and get medical supplies and essential items to these communities?
We're hearing evidence that some of the supermarkets in more regional remote parts of Australia are actually struggling with stock. And this is a consequence sometimes of the panic buying in metropolitan areas. And that then means that the stock's not as available in regional remote parts of Australia, so that concerns us greatly. But we're also part of a campaign by disability rights organisations, disabled people's organisations and the wider disability sector, where we're calling upon all governments to immediately look at 10 key actions that they need to undertake to support all Australians with disability and in particular First Peoples with disability.
Do you feel that there is a disadvantaged for First Nations and Indigenous communities, particularly since they live so far away from the capital cities?
There's no doubt there's an extra very serious layer of disadvantage, and that's based on remoteness and the ability to access medical supplies and medical support urgently is very compromised in regional remote Australia. There are not enough easy to access medical supports. So in regional remote Australia, it's absolutely a major concern.
Your organisation, First Peoples Disability Network, are calling for the National Disability Insurance Agency to fast track the Aboriginal Community Connectors in First Nations Communities initiative. Could that in some way help to improve the predicament that First Nations and Indigenous people are facing at the moment with COVID-19?
Yes, the Aboriginal Community Connector program has already been announced and already funded towards the end of last year. So we don't understand what the delay is. So that was the placement of a 40-odd Aboriginal people whose role would be to educate and inform Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal people with disability, not only about the NDIS, but around disability more generally, and to find out what supports people need. That needs to roll out immediately. It's a critical resource for engaging with Aboriginal communities, not only in relation to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, but during this time, also the coronavirus. We don't understand what the delay is. We're ready to go. We have people ready to fill those positions today, and it needs to be urgently actioned.
And with those actions, could this convince government authorities and agencies that they need to change how they go about working and trying to transition these services for Indigenous and First Nations people?
Yes, that would be a critical part of their role, is to inform community about a range of disability supports that are potentially out there. But also their role now has to be about providing accessible information around the coronavirus and providing whatever support is available to Aboriginal people with disability around Australia, information about what supports might be available. It's a critical role. It's already been funded. It needs to get moving yesterday, frankly.
Damien Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of the First Peoples Disability Network Australia, speaking there with The Wire's Jared McLaughlin. As politicians and their support staff have moved to work from home, the kitchens in some parliament houses have turned their attention to preparing food for the needy. Mark Parnell is the parliamentary leader of the SA Greens in the South Australian Legislative Council. He told me how the arrangement came about.
The Victorian Parliament had taken the step of opening up their kitchen to cooking food for the vulnerable. And the reason that they're doing that is because they have great capacity and there's hardly anyone around because most of us are working from home. So I contacted the South Australian Parliamentary Catering section and I said, look, the Victorians are doing it, we should too. And the idea fell on fertile ground. So now we've got a second parliament, the South Australian Parliament, which is cooking its normal quantities of food, except it's not going to the people who normally work in Parliament House. Their food is going to those who need it. And they've partnered with OzHarvest to make sure the food gets collected in a timely way and distributed. So it is a good news story. But one of the reasons why I think it was possible for this to happen is that some of our parliaments, but not all of them, still maintain publicly employed caterers. Certainly in South Australia and I think in Victoria, it's effectively public servants who work in the kitchens and in the cafeteria, and they want to hang on to their jobs as well. So it struck me as an absolute win-win.
Do you know what finances this in terms of the raw produce that's being used to turn out the food at the end of the day?
Parliament houses all over Australia have a budget for their operations, so I would expect that this is within their existing budget. Now, it's often thought that, you know, politicians and people who work in Parliament get free food. Well, that's not the case. We buy our lunch. But it's probably also fair to say that it's a bit cheaper than other people because there's no profit component. You know, the job of the catering division is to make sure that everyone is looked after who works in Parliament House. They're not obliged to make a profit, but they do need to cover their costs. So I don't think there's any extra budgetary cost to this. It's just that the food that politicians and staff would normally be eating and paying for is going to go for free to those who most need it.
Mark Parnell from the SA Greens. Lyndall Vandenberg is the South Australian manager of OzHarvest, the organisation coordinating delivery of the food to the people who need it. She says it's not the first time the organisation has worked with the parliamentary kitchen.
We've actually had quite a long relationship with them in terms of food rescue. But right now, what they're doing is they're looking for ways to keep their staff employed over the next few weeks. So cooking meals, especially for us to collect, which is happening twice a week. So we had our first collection on Tuesday, and that included about 300 vegetable quiches and about 30 litres of soup, plus pasta, orange juice and bread.
Where does that food go once you've received it?
We have about 130 charities that we service around Adelaide, but this particular food went to the Venetian Centre, and that is crisis care accommodation for 30 men.
How many meals does that translate to?
The food that went out on Tuesday was about 140 kilos of food, and that translates into about 420 meals.
And so is the idea that organisations get it and they can freeze some of it for future use and use some immediately?
Absolutely. They can do with it what they need to, whether they give it all away or whether they store it or whatever is up to them.
Are all of the charities and services that you normally support open still at the moment?
Not at the moment. It would be approximately 15% that have closed. However, a lot of them are actually starting to reopen. The feedback I'm getting is that they're just getting their heads around what they need to do with COVID-19 and how they need to operate in the most effective and hygienic way. So not all of them, but many are starting to reopen.
So with the last lot going to the Venetian Centre, is a plan to distribute to different organisations for each meal pickup that you arrange?
Yeah, we're looking at sending the food to other charities like Hart Street, Westcare and the Salvation Army in Adelaide.
Has OzHarvest had to change the way you operate in response to the COVID-19 situation?
We have in a sense. Our core business is food rescue, and so 100% focus at the moment is food rescue and meeting the demand for food, which has gone up a lot, even just since this has happened. We're redeploying a number of our staff into food rescue as well and doing some retraining so that we can have as many people on the ground as possible to be able to, you know, do what we do best, which is find food and deliver it to those who need it.
While organisations like Parliament House are stepping in to provide, I guess, a new influx of additional food, are there some drop-offs in resources for you that might impact your ability to do what you do?
Well, it comes down to funding, essentially. Like everyone in the charity sector, our funding's been massively impacted, so we need funding to keep our wheels turning.
And how do you get that funding?
Traditionally, we've relied on corporate fundraising and also fundraising from events. So as you can imagine, that's completely dried up. So now we're speaking to both the federal government and our local governments in our state and asking for funding directly from there.
Lyndall Vandenberg, the South Australian manager of OzHarvest. As countries across the world have cracked down on public gatherings, art galleries and museums have been forced to close their doors. But this could come with some fringe benefits to art lovers, as it pushes these institutions to take their collections online, making them available to a broader audience. Rana Devenport is the director of the Art Gallery of South Australia, which closed its doors on Wednesday, 25th of March. She spoke with me about how the gallery is responding to this challenge.
As for everybody, it's still an astonishing, unprecedented, uncommon and surreal experience. And immediately, of course, the digital has become massively important, and every single art portal that I look at are all talking about the online world for museums today. So we already had, I think, 90 activities through our START programs for young kids, and we've created a whole START at home. And the mere process of doing it and making together is a wonderful thing. And also our terrific NEO will go live and we'll be streaming music, online tutorials, artists, dance challenges via Instagram, TikTok. There is a young filmmakers competition with the winners screened online. There's a whole group of teenagers who actually control and direct and curate what's going on in that whole program. And so that whole program for the 25th of April is going to be online. So that's super exciting, and that's something we've never conceived of doing before, but the necessity has brought this to the fore. And of course, who are the best people to take us on the journey into the digital? And that's teenagers.
That's your younger audiences that you've met the needs for there. Thankfully, you've had the biennial of Australian art hanging on your walls and up for a month now throughout the Adelaide Festival, but then you've had to shut it down. How are you going to perhaps translate that and bring that to other audiences?
Honestly, we were super fortunate. We had 1 month and we had 50,000 people through Monster Theatres, you know, which was an absolute record for us. So we were just over the moon about the numbers we were getting. And of course, everything shifted at that point. That's exactly where we've really thrown a lot of resources. And we spent a couple of days last week videoing, doing interviews with artists, walkthroughs, both in the Botanic Gardens and in the gallery. And that whole video content will be accessible and online quite soon. And what is really exciting is that Stellark's 9-metre robot, the reclining stick man, is available online and live streaming 24/7, and people can control it online from anywhere in the world, which is always something that Stellark had in mind. Little did he know that it would now become the only artwork in Monster Theatres that people can interact with directly.
When people are talking about resources to maintain engagement in the arts, people have been throwing links out to other museums and galleries from around the world. Is it quite exciting to have your hand forced a little to throw the Art Gallery of South Australia into that mix?
Exactly. And what had happened already over the last couple of years, we've got a really tremendous digital bed. So a new website, new back end, been working very solidly on getting our collection online, as all museums in the world need to do. But what this has provided is the opportunity to channel all our energies into that direction. And of course, we're all looking at what the rest of the world's doing, but Europe and Asia have been ahead of us in the whole pandemic curve. And so we've been looking at the kind of leadership that's happening there. And I think we can now be a lot more creative and a lot more inventive. And I love what the Getty did. They threw out a challenge for people to recreate their favourite works of art using three things in their home with some hilarious results. So, you know, I think in this world, people are looking for avenues of play. The whole museum world, the whole gallery world is looking at that. And for us, it's always about what our artists doing and how we can support them.
Rana Devenport, Director at the Art Gallery of South Australia. New York State remains the epicentre of the American coronavirus crisis, with the total death toll now past 1,900. 1,000 of those have been in New York City, where there are horrific reports of bodies being loaded onto morgue trucks outside overwhelmed hospitals. One Australian who chose to return to New York 3 weeks ago is photographer James Hartley. He spoke to Annie Haswell from his New York apartment.
It feels a bit scary being an Australian here, I think, you know, with no unemployment benefits and a pretty shot healthcare system. It feels a bit scary, but, you know, I've made it my home here. And so to do the quarantine from my own apartment, it feels a lot more homely to do it, even though it looks like an absolute, pardon the language, shit show here. It's from what I see and, you know, the small interactions I have when I'm out, people are taking it very seriously and being very, like, polite and courteous about space and distance and hopefully getting ahead of it before it gets any worse.
And what about places like Central Park? Are they still open? Are people still out exercising?
I'm definitely seeing people out exercising. I myself, like, try and get like a run or a walk in a day. I haven't been up to Central Park. I've kind of only really been into Manhattan a couple of times.
How does it feel being there? Because it must be amazing to see New York with nobody around.
It's honestly, there's definitely, I had a moment yesterday. I rode to get some groceries and I don't know, I had my little backpack on. It was like a really gloomy day and it definitely felt dystopian, like an empty movie set, you know. It's pretty weird. It's Manhattan is empty.
Particularly when Manhattan's always been the choice of dystopian movies too. It's almost like the city most expect to see empty.
Like some I Am Legend style visuals. It was all like cloudy and gloomy. It was pretty weird. You might see people in the park and it kind of looks and feels normal, but everyone's like very spread out and just, as I said, doing the bare essential outside before they go back inside.
So why do you think New York has been hit so bad?
New York is definitely a landing spot for most of Europe. It's kind of the first port you'd land at, you know, like the old times, but, you know, as an airport, a lot of people come in through there. I think the other thing that's kind of hard to avoid is you just don't have personal space here. You know, like we live in an apartment and we've got two apartments above us and we don't have a backyard. So for most people, they don't have a backyard and they don't have a car. So if you want to do anything, you're kind of going to have to be out on the street or on public transport or in an Uber or a taxi. So it's kind of hard to, I guess, isolate yourself.
What's the feeling about leadership in the USA?
The general consensus here and for most places is people aren't really dealing with it and handling it. I mean, it's pretty easy to point a finger at Trump. I mean, he's kind of avoids responsibility. But I think what's happened is this has actually been trickling over in a lot of places. It just feels like whatever's going on here is going to happen in Australia a week or two later. I've had a lot of friends and a lot of family and people call because, you know, what's going on here is pretty... it's pretty real, and I think people metaphorically and in this time is like often look to New York for like what's happening and how things take lead. And I can definitely say that what's happening here can very easily happen in a lot of other places. Obviously, we live on top of each other here, but if people don't actually like take this seriously, it's going to get worse. It's been hard because friends are cool up in there. They're like, oh, how is it? You know, it seems weird. Oh, and, you know, people are just going about their business normally, you know, like going for surfs. And I'm like, this is going to, it's the same virus. It spreads the same way. It doesn't matter geographically where you are. If you're still being around other people, you're still susceptible to getting it or spreading it if you don't know you have it. So, like, the best thing everyone can actually do right now is literally minimize their going out and just actually staying home, taking it seriously so we can all get over this and, you know, hopefully get back to some level of normality.
Australian photographer James Hartley speaking there to The Wire's Annie Haswell from his New York apartment. That's it for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again or have your say on our stories, head to our website, thewire.org.au. There you can also sign up to podcasts of the show so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio. It's all one word. This show is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We're grateful for the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide, and I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for your company.
Around Australia.
Fine, been through heaven and hell before. It's alright if you're tired. I can carry a little more of the weight for a while. You can count on my love for sure.
For sure, for sure.
'Cause my love is unbreakable. Please tell me what's on your mind. I've been dying to know your thoughts. It's okay, you need time. I'll be here when you're ready to talk. Just relax, rest assured. You can count on my love.
Say Valentine.
Some shit, but I promise we'll get through it. I got you, you got me. That's a hell of a team, they'll see. We won't quit, we won't quit. They can count on it. Hey, I don't know about you, but I honestly do believe that we grow when we bleed. We get stronger with every that we take. It's a feat, we won't cave. With no defeat, we stay brave. And our love is unbreakable.